Hello everyone and welcome back to another week here at The Damage Report, covering American politics because that's what we're paid to do. Anyway, this week actually looks kind of brighter. I would describe today's show as fun and games after a bit of a dark beginning. Fun and games leading up to me being owned online by a former cast member of SNL. So that's gonna be fun. You're not gonna wanna miss that. In the meantime, we have someone who SNL really should have had as a cast member a long time ago. That is Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
DJ Lunchbox. Well, you are gonna know what that means very, very soon. Ladies and gentlemen, good to be here, John. Thanks for having me as always.
Good to have you here. How was the Bituation Room last night?
It was excellent. We actually got into some hard truths about the Warren campaign because she's got a new book out. So Alicia Garza of Domestic Workers Alliance and Black Futures Project, she was on, she was excellent. So listen to that wherever you get
your
podcast.
Awesome. Interesting.
Yeah.
Gonna have to see what's going on with Warren. It's funny. In all of the, and we've tried not to do too much speculation about 2024, I've had not actually thought, I wonder what Warren is going to do. And man, depending on what she does, the internet's gonna be bad. So anyway, it's gonna be real bad.
Look, I think her book, first of all, her book is called Persist. So you're not wrong in thinking about, the future. But there's also some admission in there. Maybe not as much as some folks would like. But I've read the excerpts and that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's politics and it's Earth, so everybody's awful. That's the subtitle. Anyway, thank you for being here. Glad to have you here as always. Think we're gonna have a fun show. And after the show, it being Monday and all, we're gonna do a top 10 list, which we always do every Monday for our tier 2 and tier 3 members on YouTube. And Francesca came up with a fun political one. That is, of all of the big buckaroos that we put into a variety of different things with our government, what are our top 10 things we don't want our tax dollars going to? The conservatives love talking endlessly about that stuff. We don't do nearly enough. So we're gonna have that list. It'll be available to those members on YouTube in the playlist after the show today. So with that, thank you everybody for being here. Please hit the like button, share the stream. You know what? Donate a sub if you're on Twitch. Let's have a fun little Monday tradition where we politically pay it forward a little bit and donate a sub. We've got a great community who's been doing a ton of that. Some people doing so much, it boggles my mind to this day. But let's see if we can make it a sort of Monday thing. Anyway, we're gonna have a lot of fun. We're gonna jump into that in just a few. And along the way, if you'd like to send us messages, comments, tweets, super chats, anything like that, you can do that. We'll have some fun together. And with that, let's jump into the unfortunately not fun and games part of the show. You know how we were going for herd immunity as a country? Well, forget about that, because apparently it's not going to happen. And that's not just me saying it, which wouldn't count for literally anything. It's the people who had really been hoping and working to make it a reality. According to a new report in the New York Times, more than half of adults in the US have been inoculated with at least one dose of vaccine, but daily vaccination rates are slipping, something like 20% over the past few weeks. And there's widespread consensus among scientists and public health experts that the herd immunity threshold is not attainable, at least not in the foreseeable future, and perhaps not ever. Instead, these scientists believe that rather than COVID being booted out of our country, being yeeted into the sun, it's instead going to become a manageable threat that will continue to circulate for years to come, causing hospitalizations and deaths, but in much smaller numbers. So that's fun, Francesca. Our worst fears, perhaps. I guess the worst fear would be no vaccine at all. Our second worst fear realized.
Yeah. I mean, look, 2020 crushed all hopes and dreams and even minor expectations. So, other than the 6th of January, 2021 has been kind of crushing it. I mean, the 6th also crushed it a lot. But the point is that I have very little expectations. And I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop because I'm an American and I live in this country. And I know there's always shoes that are gonna be dropping. So not reaching herd immunity.
Kids.
Oh, it's raining other shoes in this hellscape we live in. But yes, it what is awful about it is the way that it has a lot to do with distrust in the vaccine, right? And I would almost say that like having vying different pharma companies roll out their version of a vaccine also doesn't help, because now we have things that are pitted against one another. We have certain vaccines that are, you know, people snub their nose at versus others, even though they are incredibly effective and far, far better. Whatever side effects are far better than actually getting COVID. And anyone who's gotten a vaccine and felt mild symptoms has been like, oh man, I'm so glad that I don't actually have COVID, because it would be 20 times worse and that would suck.
Yeah.
But I don't think, look, the rollout's been amazing, but at the same time, it doesn't really help that we don't just have the COVID vaccine. We've got like this bizarre hierarchy of pharma as well as waiver patents that I know we're gonna go into.
Totally. Yeah. Look, if you're totally not talking about public perception and playing into misinformation, all that, having the multiple vaccines is helpful in a lot of different ways, obviously, objectively. But sure, it has caused some issues. By the way, in terms of the misinformation and, you know, some of the different things that are leading to vaccine hesitance, watch Last Week Tonight, the last episode of John Oliver's show went into it. Don't give me that, Sophie. It was a good episode. It was exactly what I thought it was gonna be. It was a bit about India and then it went into vaccines. That's what I would have made it. And so John Oliver did, because we were attached through some sort of etheric cord. But anyway, so what is going to happen? Well, we have this dark future mapped out. We don't know exactly what it looks like. How much smaller the threat becomes is currently uncertain and depends in part on how much of the nation and the world becomes vaccinated, but also how the coronavirus continues to evolve, which it will, because we won't have herd immunity. It's already clear, however, that the virus is changing too quickly. New variants are spreading too easily and vaccination is proceeding too slowly for herd immunity to be within reach anytime soon. And it's, I think, been made fairly explicit in the segment. None of this needed to happen. And I don't just mean about this story, I mean literally anything with the pandemic, none of it needed to happen. We're the worst and we're led by the worst of the worst, but we could have hit herd immunity. We could still do it if we did not have a significant chunk of the country that has taken up as their political identity that they don't want the Bill Gates super chip put in their cerebral lobe. But unfortunately, that's where we're at. And so I want to give you a little bit from Dr. Fauci, who said people were getting confused and thinking you're never going to get the infections down until you reach this mystical level of herd immunity, whatever that number is, which by the way, he has given many times. But anyway, that's why we stopped using herd immunity in the classic sense. I'm saying forget that for a second. You vaccinate enough people, the infections are going to go down. So that is a big old stepping back from what they had been saying about the efforts to hit herd immunity. And he's not wrong. Every person vaccinated makes it a little bit harder for the disease to spread and to evolve and to become worse and all of that. But it is still a massive surrender, unfortunately, but probably a realistic one, because, you know, no matter what we might aim to do, shows like this are not gonna reach virtually any of these hesitant people. They believe that I'm paid off by Soros, who is the devil. I don't know. It's just it's unfortunate, Francesca.
But I also think it's
despairing.
It is despairing. I have a couple of questions about the concept of herd immunity. First of all, the herd immunity idea was floated early on by a lot of folks who did COVID the worst, right? So like Sweden, Donald Trump. And they kept on utilizing the phrase herd immunity as basically as soon as everyone gets sick, we'll be fine. And it really, I think, indoctrinated or got people used to this idea that look, it's just a little flu and you'll survive it. Yeah, 500,000 people or more will die, but like, you know, probably not your family or maybe your family, but like whatever. And it was a terrible concept to begin with, because even the idea of herd immunity is essentially not everyone has to be inoculated a little bit. That like blanket, if 3 out of 4 are, well then the fourth is fine. So, you know, folks go around, especially in this country, thinking, well, I'm the fourth, I'm fine. Like the whole concept, again, it's been bastardized, it's not okay to use. And so for me, under a Biden administration, the fact that we started going back to this idea of herd immunity seemed really bizarre. And I don't even know why they kept on saying it. Why not just like, look, we need 70% of the American public inoculated. That's the goal, make it the goal, set the goal, call it something else, right? Mm-hmm. But don't call it herd immunity, because it just, again, it gives people the idea, the false idea, that you don't have to get vaccinated. You can fly under the radar, and basically if everyone else around you is inoculated or that person had COVID, then you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And the reality is the opposite. The reality is that those folks who have not been inoculated, not gotten the vaccine, actually can start to create a new variant of this disgusting virus we can't shake called COVID. And that, yeah, it is going to be endemic, a part of our lives. Yeah. And I don't know, man, I'm not cool with shaking hands. Just like I'm just not going back there. I'm just not going back to shaking hands. And look, I was never really a mosher to begin with, but I'm definitely not gonna like mosh it up in the future. And like wither, I mean, hardcore.
You can mosh. You just gotta put on like the Walter White, like top to bottom thing. Then you can mosh. You'll probably slip, unfortunately. Yeah, and like you said, it's just gonna be out there. And the issue is that is its own persistent tragedy that I guess will just be added to the long list of daily tragedies we have here in America. But also, they might be the breeding ground for a variant that will be able to affect those who have attempted to be responsible. And so that's a big issue too. Yeah. And look, I would say overall the focus on herd immunity, I agree with some of your concerns. I would also add, I think rhetorically, in terms of persuasion, one of the strategies was, let's get people to like pitch in together. Don't just do it for you, do it for everyone else. You don't want to kill people, do you? And all of that sounds like so common sense, but no, you stupid idiots. Americans don't care about any of that stuff. Like, conservatives they've been trained for years now to believe that an excessive concern for the well-being of others is basically the most suspect thing in the world.
Right.
I mean, whether you call it social justice warrioring or being woke or whatever, the bad people in society are those who worry about others. I'm not one of those people. I'm worried about me first and foremost.
I'm not a warrior for social justice. Ew.
Exactly. No, but really, that is yes. What they've been trained. Like, their political identity is go it alone, care about yourself, maybe your family, maybe your church, if you're feeling generous. But like only like the good ones in your church, honestly. Anyway, so as a strategy, I understand why they landed where they did, but it was sort of doomed to failure because none of the other stuff earlier about your responsibility as part of the Commonwealth and being a member of society and all that about, they don't wear masks to save lives. You think they're gonna get an injection to save lives? They won't stand at a distance from people to save lives. Why are they gonna put chips in their body or whatever? So yeah, that's difficult.
But I do think that if one of us, like this is something I haven't thought of, but if we all just like bring one friend, you know, like find a buddy who's worried about getting the vaccine. If you can find one person in your family, in your community, in your extended folks, if you can bring one person along, that will have been worth it. So I will say that, like, we all, not to get too Sesame Street on you, but we all have a part to play. No, we do. So like, let's all do that. Yeah, no, Grover for sure. Let's all do that and bring somebody along who might be hesitant, go with them ourselves. I think that would mean a lot.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. And that was, by the way, basically the conclusion of John Oliver, that obviously his show isn't gonna reach any of these people. They would never watch a minute of it, but it's on us to do the incredibly difficult job of convincing even one person that the stuff they've read on Facebook might not be true. So anyway, try that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
On The View, Meghan McCain wants to reassure you that she's not an anti-vaxxer or anything, but she has an idea of why some people don't want to get it and who is really to blame for that. So let's give her a chance to spill out her theory.
I mean, honestly, when we were first talking about vaccine hesitancy on this show months and months and months ago, a lot of it centered around minority populations who were hesitant because of valid things like the Tuskegee experiment. And the narrative and the feeling coming out was compassion and trying to convince people in a way of empathy that, you know, we all need to be in this together. We're all in this together. We should all get vaccinated together. And I think it was effective. And the messaging towards evangelicals and Republicans is, you dumb hillbillies, stay the hell away from me. And I don't think there's any way that's going to convince anyone of anything if that's the messaging coming out of the White House. I have tried in all ways. I actually had an idea for an ad campaign that was specifically targeted towards Republicans and evangelicals that I have proposed that has gone on completely deaf ears to everyone. The messaging on this is absolute garbage towards conservatives and Republicans, and it's getting worse. It's a public health crisis. I agree. We should all be vaccinated. I myself am vaccinated. I have no problem with vaccines, but the messaging is psychotic.
Yes, yes. Some of the messaging that I've been watching recently is psychotic. So there you go, Francesca. What do you think of what she said? Is it going to fall on deaf ears?
A Meghan McCain story in just 15 minutes in, John, you don't realize we don't even have the time.
I apologize.
We don't have the time to dig into that sort of just 7-layer dip of BS. My God, Meghan, number one, you don't have good ideas. Sorry, honey. You can't even like tell your hairdresser to stop putting on, you know, ugly weaves. I'm sorry. But I'm not sorry. And look, I'm sorry. Who are you sending? You're going to whitehouse.gov, info@whitehouse.gov. Hello, my name is Meghan McCain. Ever heard of me? I have an idea, .. Like, I'm just imagining, like, who is she telling her brilliant idea to? Mm-hmm. But of course, here's the thing. She's obviously, once again, like most conservatives, jealous of people of color. That's literally what she said, which is, we were so nice to people of color. Yeah, because there's historical wrongs done by American healthcare on them, but not necessarily when it comes to white folks, unless we're talking about the general lack of healthcare altogether. That's a different combo. So there's that. There's a why can't we just be like people of color? Because you're not an oppressed class really at all. You've done the oppressing. Secondly, just like Meghan McCain always does, she doesn't look at her own party. She does not look at the leadership in the Republican Party, who it is on to get the evangelicals and conservatives and whomever else and QAnon people and whatever else makes up their base. It's on them to show the leadership to get their people vaccinated. You think they're going to listen to Biden? You think they're gonna like roll through and be like, oh, look, Kamala's got the vax. Kamala did a nice ad. Like, no, they're not gonna listen to Democrats because it's all partisan in their brains. And guess who made it that way? Republicans. So it's on Republicans to take care of their own. They should be leading the way, i.e. open Meghan McCain's email, you guys, because she has got ideas.
They fell on deaf ears. They wouldn't even listen to her. But what she wants is she wants to have her cake and eat it too. She wants to be able to say, I'm totally pro-vax. Like, I got it. I think they should get it. But I don't feel like any of this is on them whatsoever. The fact that they have willingly gobbled up months of misinformation from the right. I'm not mad at them for doing that. and for believing whatever makes them comfortable about the vaccine. I'm not even mad at the misinformers. I'm not mad at Fox News doing a 4 month long campaign to get them to feel like not only should they be worried about the vax, but it is the most patriotic thing imaginable to be concerned about the vaccine and all of that. No, they're not to blame. It's for the person that said you dumb hillbillies. Has there been some of that? Probably. I don't even know exactly who that's a reference to.
Right?
And I guarantee that is like, that is number 73 on the list of causal factors for them not choosing to get the vaccine. But she doesn't want to come out and say, like Tucker, maybe it doesn't work and they're lying to you. But she wants to be a part of it, to get a little bit of it. She doesn't want to be one of those ones that's like telling people to be responsible and not kill themselves and others. And so she's trying to have a rhetorical cake and eat it too. And in the end makes the whole thing about some like a lib, I guess, who she doesn't even identify that is actually responsible for conservatives choosing to continue to get this virus.
No, it is an egg avatar on Twitter who said something about hillbillies. Like she makes it sound like it's coming out of the White House, just like printed on official letterhead about how, quote, hillbillies aren't getting the vaccine. Come on, Megan, please. Just mute people on Twitter. It's not real life. Stop.
Exactly. The world is facing multiple crises from COVID-19. Many of them, at least currently, do not need to be the way they are. We could have provided access to the formulas to produce COVID vaccines to be made domestically in countries around the world, which could allay a great deal of the suffering that we're currently seeing. We have, as of right now, chosen as a country to not do that. Now, thankfully, there are some people who are pushing back against this. Let's go now to Senator Bernie Sanders.
Our vaccine distribution, you know, we have a lot here. Should we start sharing it faster than we are now, particularly when you see what's going on in our hemisphere and in India? Should we be more aggressive here? It seems like we've been a bit, some might argue, overly cautious about our vaccine supply.
Well, I think a couple of things, Chuck. The answer is yes. I think we've got to obviously make sure that every American gets vaccinated as quickly as possible. But I do think not only do we have a moral responsibility to help the rest of the world, it's in our own self-interest. Because if this pandemic continues to spread in other countries, it's gonna come back and bite us at one point or another. But the second thing we should do is not only make sure that excess vaccines in the United States get around to countries that need it, we should deal with this issue through the World Trade Organization of protecting the intellectual property rights of the drug companies. And I think what we have got to say right now to the drug companies, when millions of lives are at stake around the world, yes, allow other countries to have these intellectual property rights so that they can produce the vaccines that are desperately needed in poor countries. There is something morally objectionable about rich countries being able to get that vaccine, and yet millions and billions of people in poor countries are unable to afford it.
Yeah, Francesca, I love his last point, especially like we obviously are just sort of casually used to the fact that in the vast majority of cases, your life is going to be better off, better protected, extended, and all of that by being in one country versus another. But this is, it's such a sharp distinction. Those maps showing like levels of vaccination in different countries are so predictable, so severe. I wish that there were more politicians speaking up about this, but it's pretty rare, at least in the Senate at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the question that Chuck Todd asked Bernie was interesting because it was essentially like, should we give the vaccine we have that is going unused elsewhere? And my initial reaction, which is so, so depressing, is how quickly Fox News and Republicans and conservatives would weaponize any attempt to give a vaccine supply that we have here, even though, like we've covered before, they are not encouraging their base or their voters to be vaccinated. They are allowing and ensuring the vaccinations go unused. And so, but if Biden ever, or if the White House ever tried to negotiate something, unless it was like a, you know, let's move a plant back from Mexico to the United States. Like it'd have to be really couched in a lot of like, you know, sort of like nationalistic, you know, almost not Trumpian, but like our country's so xenophobic. And we've been so anti-immigrant that I feel like how that would look would be terrible. But an easy workaround to that is to put pressure on the Biden administration and for Biden to actually, yes, put pressure on Big Pharma to allow intellectual property rights to be waived. And apparently, the Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, who is the Commerce Secretary, is like basically one of the biggest roadblocks into stopping this from happening. She's lobbied on behalf of Big Pharma on private healthcare companies before. She helped hospitals avoid any kind of lawsuits in the case of COVID deaths and all this. So she has not been on the right side when it comes to Big Pharma versus the people, healthcare versus industry versus the people. Sure. And she's right up there in the White House. So it's like, this was an article in American Prospect. And apparently there are folks in the White House who are like, no, we should release this. We should put pressure on these pharma companies. And there are others who are like, not so fast, because, you know, I have a paycheck coming.
Yeah, having him surrounded by, I don't even know. Biden has said some things that seem to indicate some level of empathy, but he also has basically talked about America first. Like, we're going to help out, we're going to give some money, we're going to give some vaccine, but first, everybody needs to be able to have access to it. And by the way, in America, virtually everyone does have access to it. Like, we've reached that threshold and people don't want it. Those numbers are dropping, they're going to continue to drop. But he's also surrounded by people that have a more directly corporate set of motivations for stopping this from happening. And it needs to be done. Like, I don't know how many different ways we can stress it. I would hope that the moral argument would be enough for a country as religious as ours, saving lives rather than adding a few zeros to some of the most profitable corporations in the history of the world's bank account. Seems like a good argument. But even if that wasn't a good enough argument, you have the public health pragmatism of trying to not have global environments that are going to produce variants of this virus that are going to come back to wipe us out potentially. Or like, if it's just a real politic thing, like other countries are doing vaccine diplomacy, Russia and China are doing these. We could be doing that too. We're choosing not to. And by the way, like, shipping the vaccine is fine. That is not nearly as good as helping get factories set up in other countries actually produce them, especially for the variants of the vaccine that have to be refrigerated and all of that. Those are obviously very difficult to ship. Maybe J&J is easier, I don't know. But we could be doing that. We should have been doing that for months, even starting now. Like, if Biden woke up and he was like, oh my God, I want to be a moral guy, I'm going to cancel student loan debt and then vaccines for these countries.
But that's like a really important point.
Hold on 1 second. Yeah. Well, because let's look at the Indian numbers. So 3,400 deaths on May 2nd. How many months would it take if we decided today to really help? How many months of 3,400 or maybe 4,400 deaths or maybe 7,000 deaths in the near future? We can't put a value on human lives because the math's hard, but theoretically you could. And they are. These pharmaceutical companies very much have put a dollar value on the lives of people in these different countries. And apparently, I guess it's a lot of money, I guess. Sorry, Francesca, what were you gonna say?
No. And I think there is a cost benefit analysis. They're like, well, we're not getting money back for that. Oh, there's too many people, like, their government hasn't paid us, you know, like billions of dollars. So, it's not really, better just do some stock buybacks and reinvest in the next pandemic. Ooh, we're real excited about that. Like, I think what you pointed out about vaccine diplomacy is super important, because meanwhile, the United States and even folks in the Biden administration continually discuss how we support democracy creation around the world. Oh, what's going on in Venezuela? What's going on in all these different countries? Oh, that we care about democracy. But when push comes to shove, what do we do? How do we intervene in most countries? Militarily. How do we intervene in most countries? Selling weapons. And when it comes to something like health, when it comes to a program we can so clearly help out in and would, like, in terms of accolades, clout, goodwill towards countries we're trying to build with, would go very, very far. We don't got it. We don't have the infrastructure to actually help out when it comes to real, you know, life and death healthcare.
Yeah. Like you made the great point that they would lose their mind. Like, if you threw 5 doses of J&J in a backpack and shipped it to Africa, Fox News would talk about it for 6 weeks straight. So any sort of wide scale program, they would not accept. Even though they would rather inject poison into their lungs than take the vaccine. So there's a weird inconsistency there, but you're totally right. Like, I don't know, I guess everyone would freak out if I said, you know, considering we could identify what for basically every country in the world, some way that America has historically devastated it, caused massive loss of lives, economic problems, government overthrow, all of that. Let's put $1 trillion. Let's get rid of if we can't get rid of the intellectual property protections, we're just not gonna do that. Then let's buy the doses. Let's put $1 trillion into buying doses and shipping mm-hmm. them to every country that needs them as one of the most massive economic like measures of goodwill since, I don't know, some components of the Marshall Plan, a lot of that was pragmatism too, but let's do that. Let's do a massive moral good, a massive pragmatic public health good. Let's like if he wants to restore the soul of America, that's not restoring the soul of America. That's actually kind of having a good soul for once and telling the world all of our massive resources that have largely been generated historically by exploiting other countries and our own people and obviously the legacy of slavery and all that. We're gonna put some of that money into righting a bit of the wrongs. We can't get back the lives that were lost, but we're gonna try to save your lives now if we can. We could do that, but everyone would freak out if we proposed $1 to $2 trillion for that. It wouldn't just be Sean Hannity. Chuck Todd would lose his mind if AOC proposed that yesterday. Bernie was pushing for that next week. But we could do it. We could, if we wanted to. Just 6 months ago, almost exactly 6 months ago, 181 days ago, Donald Trump faced re-election. He entered that day the most powerful individual human on earth. And it's been 6 months, so let's check in. How is this former titan of political power and social influence doing? Well, this is apparently how he's spending his nights.
Let's see what they find. I wouldn't be surprised if they found thousands and thousands and thousands of votes. So we're gonna watch that very closely. And after that, you'll watch Pennsylvania and you watch Georgia and you're gonna watch Michigan and Wisconsin and you're watching New Hampshire. They found a lot of votes up in New Hampshire just now. You saw that? Because this was a rigged election, everybody knows it, and we're gonna be watching it very closely. But start off by, you just take a look, it's on closed circuit, I guess it's on all over the place, because everyone's talking about yesterday, front page of the New York Times, they didn't wanna write it. But that's because they thought they were gonna have a negative decision, and the judge gave us a positive decision.
He's standing there. Like he just walked out and there's people at the club who admittedly they want it. They're not at that club because they don't like Donald Trump, but he just wanders out to tell people about how he won the election 6 months after he lost it. Just standing there for the most part looking like his arms have been pinned onto his body and they're just hanging slack. His body can't take it anymore. And that's how he's spending it. So there, Franceschi is talking about the audit of the Arizona results, which has been, I was gonna like sum up some of it, but it's just sheer insanity. Like everybody involved in it thinks Antifa's gonna like paratroop in to stop it. They've got their black lights. They're sure that they're gonna find stuff. They're not gonna find anything. Arizona wasn't stolen. No, now New Hampshire was stolen too. Every state was just stolen. This is so incredibly sad. And he is the guy that they still say is the most powerful person in the Republican Party. They're not even necessarily wrong, but that is what the most powerful person in the Republican Party is doing with his time.
Yes, I love the bassist in that video. There's just like a bassist player off to the side. Just like, mm-hmm. Oh, I was right in the middle of play that funky music, whatever. which is what you would play. He's just standing off in the corner like, ugh, this again. This is like the third time he's been interrupted. The best description of this sort of like old man wandering halls talking about how he won an election was Molly Knight, I think, wrote something about Miss Havisham, who is from Great Expectations, which is just like ever since she got like stood up at the altar, it's like Miss Havisham wandered her home day and night, ranting about her betrothed who never appeared. Like it's so perfect. That's exactly what Trump is. He's just put him in a nightie. Somebody put him in a nightie, please. Because that's exactly, okay, it's not a diaper, guys, all right? 2021 Francesca is like just way more on point. It's nighty Trump, not diaper Don.
Way more professional.
Way more profesh.
He is haunting Mar-a-Lago. He's still technically alive, but he's haunting that place. And the thing is, like, showing you the video and the like bassist who has to listen to it and the like reluctant claps from his face. By the way, again, those are people who like him. That is bad enough. But like, who in the audience, and feel free to leave a comment, thinks that this is the only time he's done this? Who doesn't think that he does that every single night? And we know how he gives speeches. He's using the same words every night. That bassist has heard this. Yeah. That bassist is living the saddest political Groundhog's Day that you can imagine. It's like every day it's another rant with him like just barely not toppling off the stage. Every day is the same.
Yeah. It's scary because you wonder, like, the delusion, it continues. And I feel like President Biden has not really addressed Trump or Trumpism or like the allegations the false allegations around the election, which is a strategic choice. And as much as I want to ignore it and to have it go away, I am secretly curious. I mean, we've got like however many, you know, hundreds of like, and you know, voter suppression laws that are rolling through. But I also feel like maybe the lesson that some conservatives have coming out of that election was, oh, we didn't stack the courts enough. And all we have to do is, we just have to stack them more. And that way we won't lose those cases because everyone will be just as delusional as we are and completely partisan. So it is, again, I'm glad Biden's getting to work, but I am also scared that, again, this is like the zombie movie and, you know, the hand is like coming out through the through the dirt, still alive, and we'll see.
Yeah, and incredibly resistant to learning anything. And he wants to make sure that he does not want any of them to, like something like 30% of Republicans say the election was legit. And that's too much for him. So his most recent presidential statement was the election of 2020 will be forever known as the big lie. So you see what he did there? Like him trying to overturn it, lying about it was the big lie. Now the election was the big lie. I see what you did there. That's definitely—
you can't have big lie. We gave you fake news.
It's the same thing. It is literally the same. That's the comparison I made in the pre-show.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, hang in there, buddy. No, but can you imagine, like I don't know. Do you have a president that— I'm gonna move on a sec. Do you have a president that you like and that you respect or whatever? Imagine if they did this. Imagine if Barack Obama did this. No, imagine if Bernie came out and just relitigated 2020 or 2016 primary over and over and over. How sad that would be. Last week, we talked about the fall off in the media following the election. Some networks have lost a lot of their audience. The right has had some trouble. Not really Fox News. They've really been doing okay. But Newsmax, their website, went from 12 million unique viewers in January to 7 million unique viewers in February, down to 5 million unique viewers in March. They had looked like they were ready to overtake Fox, and then they kind of lost that. Now, that obviously isn't good for the CEOs there. It's not good for their hosts. They wanna be on top. So they're working with a couple of different ideas of what they need to cover, what they need to focus on. Here is one of the most recent efforts.
All right, folks, I want you to take a look at this. Joe Biden today getting on Marine One, and he stops and picks up, I think it's a dandelion, but it's a dandelion that hasn't even blossomed into a flower yet. Like, it gives everybody asthma. So you blow it, it goes everywhere, and then everybody starts sneezing. Well, he picks up the weed and gives it to Jill as what I guess is supposed to be some kind of a sweet gesture. He's getting dandelions all over the place. I say it was a planted dandelion there, who knows?
Yeah, well, most plants were, but that's the saddest thing. Like, why is he giving her a flower, this woman he loves? Blah, it's just a weed. Like, he gave her a box of chocolates. It just makes you— it's all sugar. It's gonna make you fat. It makes your like teeth a little bit like dark until you lick it off. And like, he probably even make that chocolate anyway. Love isn't real. Like,
dude, are you in love with Jill, bro? Like, You got a thing for Jill here? Because you're like not even a good flower. Come on, like, oh, romance is back in the White House. I love this clip. We talked about it on the Bituation Room last night. It's wrong on all the levels, but I love how they're just fundamentally trying to make a very sweet moment. Just a sweet old man. Like, I haven't been this moved by an old man since the movie Up. You know, this is just like, oh God.
No,
that was like such an up thing to do.
It is an up thing to do. I think the media reaction initially just to the clip, like, was like the romance back in the, like, I don't care. Like, I don't have a problem with it. I'm a normal person in a normal, healthy relationship. So seeing two people who like each other doesn't fill me with rage. But I don't want this, like, oh, the White House is this romantic Camelot. I'm not interested in that either. But however much I don't like that, this guy losing his S over a flower being handed off, I don't be that person. Don't be that, like, new report, he named a star after Jill. You, that star's probably dead by now. Probably went supernova, you idiot. Like, don't be that person, man.
No, but
and I don't.
He also says it's a planted dandelion, which basically means like he thinks it was fake. There's a conspiracy here. We have to get to the bottom of. It's on the level, of course, of the, like, you know, who was it? Major is like a scroungy dog or whatever.
Which they talked about.
Yes, which they talked about. But I think my favorite part, and this is very interesting, which I did talk about on my podcast, but I want to talk about here, which is that he gets the life cycle of the dandelion totally wrong. He has no idea what he's talking about. Dandelions start yellow. Then they go back in, they dry up, and then they come out as this, like, white, you know, like the little wispies, and then they blow around and, like, you know, and plant other seeds. It's very beautiful. And like I was saying, I do think that Joe Biden is sort of the wispy white dandelion of presidents. He's like on his way out, trying to do, but look, he's in the other side of the life cycle, but still doing beautiful things.
And like the dandelion, he was planted there by George Soros.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
It's a cloned dandelion. Can't it just be lame and fake love? By the way, I haven't actually said who that is. So that is, I had to look this up. This is Newsmax Hope host Grant Stinchfield, which is totally not a made up name. Anyway, they're all made up. Anyway, why can't it just be lame and love doesn't exist? He has to throw in at the end that it was planted. Like, it's like he has this knee jerk reaction. Wait, I put across a theory that can't be credibly described as conspiratorial. Gotta throw something in there. Like, you already were crazy. Why does it also have to be that a Secret Service member put a flower in the field? Weeds exist, dude. Look it up. Anyway, by the way, I just want to, I don't want to be too hard on Newsmax. That would be unfair. Okay. I want to be very clear. As sad as that was, as insane as that was, as much as that does make me, like, sort of break my heart for Grant Stinchfield's relationship history, he's not the only one, because I looked a little bit more and Laura Ingraham did have this on.
Happy, lovesick, romantic ever, Laura, or the most insecure spouse in DC. Whatever the case, she can see you, pal. You don't need to do a whole mime act of devotion and love and all of that.
It was cute.
I also feel when you have to work that hard after many years of marriage, Laura, something's wrong, okay? We need to call Dr. Phil. Can you invite Dr. Phil in to come help explain this to me?
Yeah.
I don't mind the affection, but the gratuitous stuff, we just don't care. And we don't need to see it.
Well, get a room, as I would say.
In the past, I've said to these people, y'all need Jesus. Y'all need a hug bad from a person who loves you and accepts who you are. He was so crazy there that Laura Ingraham kind of defended Joe Biden. She seemed to like it. I think she said it was cute or something like that, right?
She said
he
it was cute.
Too crazy for Laura Ingraham.
But she was like, I understand why we have to have you on and why we're doing this segment. It's because we don't know how we're actually attacking Biden's plans, many of which are incredibly popular with our voters and the people who watch the show. Anyway, let's keep talking about a dandelion. yeah, get a room. Like that dude, yes, that dude is so sad. You're a grown ass man, like on a major network talking about how you don't gotta put in work in a relationship. Like after a certain amount, you know, it's like a car, it just goes and you just let it careen off the cliff and watch it burn and then eat popcorn and have the flames just flickering in your eyeballs.
Yeah. I learned a lot from it. So I mean, my wife and I, we've only been married for like a year and a half or whatever. And over the weekend, in the morning, cause I woke up first, I made coffee for her. And then I realized, no, why am I trying so hard? And I spilled it on the ground. That'll teach her. Love is supposed to be lazy. Damn it. Anyway. Oh, Bill Maher is at it again, attempting to reassure his audience that that stereotype that like old people are out of it and can't follow tech, that's not what it is. It's not that he doesn't get it, it's that it shouldn't be got. And he's got a particular target for his rage today. Let's listen.
You think someone 80 is hopeless because they can't use an iPhone? Maybe the one who's hopeless is the one who can't stop using it. You think I'm out of it because I'm not on Twitch? Well, maybe I get Twitch, but I just think people watching other people play video games is a waste of time.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's supposed to be ironic that in his thing, which is his monologue, which is this idea that old men are out of it is wrong. Now, let me give you the oldest man comment I've ever heard. You kids and your Twitches. No, you don't actually get it. You demonstrated that you fundamentally don't get the culture of Twitch, why people find that to be interesting, the concept that one can disagree about what is entertaining. There's quite a bit that you don't seem to understand. Twitch is just the jumping off point.
Yeah,
Francesca, your show
stopped being entertaining like 10 years ago, buddy. Like, I feel like, yeah, at Bush, maybe you had a heyday, but I've never, look, I felt like it was insensitive throughout this entire pandemic to say this phrase, but I feel comfortable now bringing it back and just loudly proclaiming, okay, boomer. My God, Bill Maher, you are such boomer humor. I get it. You're for like a 90s Democratic dad who like doesn't like Hillary and like thought there was nothing wrong with Clinton. He didn't do anything wrong. Well, I like Clinton. He played the saxophone. You know, like there's just this boomer humor that Bill Maher has. And look, you can have a take that you don't like Twitch or that you think that like, you know, people need to stop looking at their phones. You can make fun of Gen Z all you want, but like do it with jokes. Wasn't your show supposed to be like a comedy show instead of just like a very like pulling your like glasses down, like, and the person who can't put down the iPhone.
Nailed it. Original thought achieved.
So bad. The writing is so bad. I'm so sorry. I just feel like Bill Maher's audience, they're aging, they're dying. That's why he's allying himself with 80-year-olds, because that's really like the upper, like that's basically who watches Maher and still really likes it and finds it relevant. I like that he's not PC, but my God, he has not had a good take in so long. The writing is lazy and they need to give me that show. Anyway.
That's not a bad idea. I haven't watched it in a bit. I remember, I think one of the episodes that stopped me from watching it was his like big rant at the end of the episode was about how movies have too many chase scenes nowadays.
Oh God.
I just thought, oh my God. And it bothers me because he, you know, he used to hold a certain position. Like he was important in some ways. He also physically reminds me of my grandfather. Like he looks a lot like my grandfather. And he couldn't be more unlike him. That really bothers me every time I see his face. But anyway, like this isn't even really about Bill Maher. It's let's not be that way. Like everybody likes some things and doesn't like other things. The idea that I am superior because the things I like aren't a waste of time and you dumb dummies are wasting all of your time is a very sad way to live your life. I would not actually want to do this, but I would propose a hypothetical experiment where we follow Bill Maher around and find how he spends his time. And we get to decide if it's a waste of effing time. What are you doing all day? In investment? Are you like, are you just working out all day? Like every minute is efficient and appropriated correctly and all that? No, people enjoy things. Like
no,
your inability.
Sorry, Bill Maher is snipping at his assistants and for not like getting the piece of lint off of his nice suit, and also probably cutting all the good jokes out of the monologues and insisting that no, it's better this way. And the writers are like, okay, bro, okay.
Yeah, I know I'm just waiting for the comment from Bart about watching Twitch game. Oh no, it's coming. Anyway, like I used to watch a good amount of gameplay on Twitch at one point. I don't really now, but I might at some point. It's watching something for entertainment. It is exactly the same thing as watching sports or watching a reality show, which is again, just watching people doing the thing they're doing and being entertained by it. I like some of that. I don't like other stuff. I might occasionally even speak out against it, but I don't imply that I am morally or intellectually superior because of the hobbies I've accrued necessarily. That's just a really bad way to live your life. And if you're gonna have it, at least be self-aware enough to keep it a bit to yourself, that feeling. The idea that you would make it sort of like the standout moment of your like your show is such a weird thing to do. I don't like it. Don't live like that. Anyway, really fast, let's see. Maybe I was wrong about Bart. Bart says, I love wasting my time like anybody else. It's fun. If I had a choice to watch other people play video games or sit and watch the paint dry in a tool shed, I'll pick watching the paint dry because the benefit of that is that you can smell the fumes and get high. Sorry, John, and I gotta ride with Bill Maher on his take. For those of you throwing the okay boomer towards me, I say to you, okay, zoomer.
No, okay. It's
well, look, Bart is siding with Bill Maher, but to be fair, Bart is very high on paint fumes right now. I don't know if he knows what he's saying. Anyway.
Yes. No, look, I hate watching Twitch. I'm both. I don't like Bill Maher and I don't like watching gaming because it reminds me of being a little sister and like, you know, dying on the first jump as Luigi and then Mario, my older brother, being like boo doo boo boo doo an hour and a half later. And I'm like, when do I live my life? So I straddle both of these worlds here.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I mostly agree. I don't watch the vast majority of it. I think a lot of the personalities who do video game streaming are really annoying. But if you enjoy it, my job is not to yuck your yum. That's not my thing.
Yuck.
It definitely is. I like doing a lot of things that most of you would probably find to be incredibly boring. And that's okay. So I recently moved and I have to set up my office. And now my office is mainly gonna be for my own work, but we also produce content and you never know when the next COVID is gonna hit and we're gonna have to be shooting the damage report out of it. So I wanna make sure that it's fit for shooting, that it has a background that's gonna look good or whatever, appropriate for the type of content we do. So I put up the sort of tweet that gets Ben Mankiewicz to make fun of me all the time, trying to set up a new home office that I'll sometimes need to shoot content in. And so once again, trying to figure out what to put in the background or on the wall. Any suggestions? Now, many people put perfectly reasonable suggestions. Like I like backgrounds that have shelves with interesting stuff to look at, like collections you have, travel souvenirs, old stuff, figurines, plants, books, or whatever. Perfectly fine idea. Cassandra says wood paneling, easily faked with just trim and paint, plants and art, fireplace. Some of the electric ones are pretty decent looking these days. Cassandra has expansive idea of how big this room is. It is not like that, but thank you. Some people started to give advice that might have been a bit sarcastic, like Rich W. Love, who said Cenk Uygur's drawing of you. I don't think that's a good idea. But then things took a turn with Michelle Clement suggesting that Leslie Jones give me advice and in fact tagged Leslie Jones, to which I responded not tagging Leslie Jones because I imagined late on a Sunday night, the last thing she wanted or would engage in is giving me advice. I just said, Leslie, save me. To which she promptly responded, send pic. So this is Leslie Jones of SNL, who I think is incredibly funny and is known for destroying people online. I apparently forgot that fact for a few moments and decided to send her an image of what the TDR home shoot studio looked like for most of the pandemic. So I sent this shot saying, this is how The Last Office looked, basically just board games, but it's political content. Not quite right, right? Just a random shot, to which she responded, okay, where do I start? First, you look like an Instagram DJ. I would have never thought you were some political dude, so don't know if that's what you were going for. Is that a gold chain? I'm just saying, DJ Lunchbox, I hope this was practice. Show me what you're doing right now. And when I sat back at my desk and saw that, I thought, oh my God, what has become of me?
And you do. You yeah. are. She's not wrong, man.
Is That's
she,
why it hurts. It just, I look like an Instagram DJ.
You because you're given some Khaled vibes, you know, with like the close shave and like the facial hair and everything. So the DJ Lunchbox, which is funny because it's more like DJ board game, boo boo boo, which I don't know which one is.
Box come from
nerdier because they look like lunchboxes behind you, John.
I told her they were board games anyway.
What did
but
she
what I
say?
Love about it is she's dead. No, I said in that first comment it's board games.
They're, they're actually board games.
Do I have anyway? So first of all, it hurts because she's totally right. I look at that picture and I think, yeah, that guy probably wants to be an Instagram DJ but isn't succeeding at it. And second of all, she has come up with something. Instagram DJ that is simultaneously worse than just being a guy on Instagram or being a DJ. It's worse than both. Anyway, she said, show me what you're doing right now. I did not send her a photo because I could not come up with anything I would send her that would not result in me being immolated again. So I'm gonna work on it. Maybe I'll do something in studio just to try to tamp down the flames a bit. But she has destroyed me. And yeah, in my Twitter bio, I am now DJ Lunchbox. I'll just say that.
Very cool that she responded. Is she actually, this is me not knowing, is she the Room Raiders person or is she just?
No, no. I think she's like, she's interacted with them. And she comments on like MSNBC, what happens on MSNBC and stuff in Got a very it. Like explicit way. So that's why someone unleashed her on me. Anyway, but it was funny and love Leslie Jones, obviously. She's missed on SNL. Welcome one and all to the weekly top 10 list with me, John, and Francesca Fiorentini. Francesca, how's it going?
Very good.
I'm glad to have you here, especially because you came up with the top 10 list this week. This week, the top 10 things we don't want our tax money going to anymore.
Very relevant.
Caveat, super relevant. My caveat is, obviously, it doesn't work that way. Like, especially conservatives seem to think like any individual thing, like they should be able to opt out of. No, it doesn't work that way, but we can try to influence it by electing the right people. That said, if it was up to us, here's what we would put. Any important caveats or anything like that from you before we launch into it, Francesca?
No, just that, yes, whenever we talk about tax dollars not going to places, it's always like, nuh-uh, I don't want to pay for my neighbor's kids to go to school. And you're like, why? Why not? Why are you like, it's like $3 out of your, you know, whatever. Like,
I think it's way less than that out of their thing. But
exactly. Yeah. It's way less. Calm down, you know? So it's always the right saying, like, well, I don't use this. I don't take the bus. Like, that's.
Exactly. Okay. Well, look. I'm assuming bus is your number five, right?
Oh, sure.
What's your number five?
Well, yeah. No, I definitely have written. I will be honest. I have written on the outside of my like IRS forms and tax stuff. Like, please, not for war. I've done that before, and
I really have.
And I will say, obviously, that doesn't mean anything. I will say I do know, and I have been closely allied with the war tax resistance folks. There are people, there's a group out of New York. They've been going for decades and decades, I think since like the 60s. And they basically withhold paying federal income taxes basically as an anti-war protest. Now, a lot of these folks don't make that much money. We're not talking about corporate lawyers, but we're talking about like people who make nonprofit salaries. And they do get audited and they fight and they fight and they fight. But the basic premise is that, and that would be my number five, is warfare, that so much of the US tax dollar does go to either current or former military ventures, because apparently we're still paying for them, even though haven't really had a lot of success, but it's something like it vacillates between like 41 cents to like 51 cents of the dollar of every tax dollar goes to current or former like military or sort of anything to do with the military. And that's morally reprehensible. I do not believe that that's where my money should go. So anyway, shout out to the war tax resistors. And that'd be my number five is war.
Wow, I am shocked. I would have predicted that would be your number one. Francesca Fiorentini, the anti-war warrior. The anti-warrior. I like that. I'm gonna go with that. With it number five. God only knows what your number one will be. I like that, obviously. And so much of the money goes there. And people don't think that it, people's estimations when you ask them to break down what they think their tax dollars go towards are always wrong. That's one of the ones where they always think it's less than it is. Yes. Anyway, I will also say for mine as I launch into my five, there is a very wide range in how much money we're talking about here. So my list is very much not the five worst things that cost the most money. So yeah. For instance, my number five is not a big portion of our budget. It's not nothing, but I don't like the money that goes to charter schools. Don't message me about charter schools, by the way. That said, I know enough public school teachers. I don't want to hear it. But anyway, and this is very much a state by state thing, how that actually works. But a good amount of money does go. And I actually read there was this report that was done about the charter school program, the CSP, between 2006 and 2014. Tons of money went to it was something like 35%, it's probably about 2,000 schools, charter schools, that never opened, never held classes, took in tons of federal money. Jeez. They ghost schools, they didn't actually exist, they never actually functioned. But even if they do, I don't like the even proportionally small amount of money that goes towards something that is obviously designed to undercut the public school system, to destroy it from within. Oh, by the way, of the states with those ghost schools, the ones with the state with the most was Michigan, home of Betsy DeVos. So I thought that was a nice little note.
That is anyway, such a good one. That is so good and so important to remember. They're like rife with fraud, and your boy John Oliver has done really good stuff on charter schools and how some of them are like, yeah, they were like nightclubs that were just turned into a charter school. Yeah, one of them was like in an old nightclub. And like never even launched. And these guys have like, you know, planes and like third condos and boats. And it's just so much corruption in charter schools. That is such a good one. Also, it's Teacher Appreciation Day. So
I did not know that.
I know we didn't talk about it on the main show.
But
yes, but a shout out to all the teachers. Okay.
By the way, I like the normalization of referring to TDR as the main show. Anyway, go on. What's your number four?
I didn't say it. I didn't start that. Don't start drama.
Fired.
Don't start drama with me. Okay, number four. I'm not sure if Senator Kirsten Gillibrand successfully got this passed or changed, but I do. She had a policy, and I believe that might have been successful. But basically, taxpayers were paying for sexual harassment or assault defense for Congress people, straight up, that if a congressperson was accused of sexual misconduct, that their defense, their lawyers were paid for through their taxpayers and through taxpayer money. I don't want my taxes to go to any of that. And I believe that might have been reformed by now, but oh my God, that's at the federal level. Like who knows? You know, it might be also happening at other levels, state level, city level, etc. But you know that some of our tax dollars wind up there.
Yeah, I'm seeing in March it was cut from a piece of legislation, but in April, I'm having a hard time figuring out exactly. But yeah, you're totally right. I remember when that became a couple of years ago a topic of conversation. It's absolutely insane. How could they possibly get? That's actually going to tie into, well, not my number four. But that will come back, actually. My number four is going to be, I think the one that most people watching this probably would have predicted I'd put, and I assume most people would have this on their list. And again, not a huge percentage of the budget or anything like that, but literally 1 cent going towards subsidizing fossil fuel, dirty energy. Yeah. I would even expand it to other sorts of industries like that. I'm talking about industries that are both well established and highly profitable. That they receive any subsidies whatsoever is not just forcing us to subsidize the continued wrecking of our environment. It doesn't make any economic sense whatsoever. It just doesn't. It shouldn't be allowed. How could it possibly have survived the Obama years? How has it still survived so far in the Biden years? I don't care if it's only tens of billions of dollars. It needs to go. We shouldn't be funding it. If he wants us to believe he's taking the environment seriously, he needs to get rid of it anyway. And financially, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Ugh, that's such a good one.
I make good lists, yeah.
I don't know. Three? I don't know. With I guess I'm like I'm torn on what to put, but I feel like mine will be similar. Like my number three is yes, like handouts to and subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, but also I want to tack onto that to like the farming sector and specifically the massive like you know industrialized whether it's like poultry or corn or what or like cows
that's
and
true.
Just the
yeah.
ways that the ways that yeah or even like soy the ways that we are funding a very and subsidizing just the massive conglomeration and further consolidation in the farming sector rather than subsidizing small farmers who are like growing a like not monocrops so like a homogeneous amount of crops farmers sure. who are using permaculture using like you know better regenerative soil techniques that actually help the land you know versus just sort of fake inflating our corn and soy products so that like you know, farmers who are generally like, you know, the bigger farms that survive can just kind of flip a switch and be like, all right, I know I'm going to make this amount for the year and doo-doo-doo. And I don't really totally. Have, I don't employ that many people. So like, I just feel like the farm subsidies are also kind of like really disingenuous and we need to reorganize that. That's not a huge thing in my craw, but I really think it's attached to the fossil fuel stuff.
I think it makes sense. It makes me wish that mine had been broader. Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I mean, fossil fuel is the one that gets the most publicity, but it's not necessarily even the most money, and it's certainly not the only money. I think you're totally right there. My number three is going to, I'm now going to add in your sexual harassment defense thing. Mine was just generally, the way I worded it was almost anything that specifically financially benefits the president, the cabinet, and most politicians. Because they're all rich, we've decided we're only going to elect rich people. And then we also give them everything. And I think that the media did a pretty good job of really focusing on it in the Trump years. The insane amounts that were put towards trips for Trump's family or for him to go to Mar-a-Lago, the security bills. I mean, we're talking about millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars for some of the wealthiest people in our society, which is also true of most of the cabinet. It's true of a lot of our politicians. Now, you might say, well, it's not supposed to be that way. Congresspeople are supposed to be able to be working class and stuff like that. Well, they're not. But I would also say I'm totally cool with them continuing those things. If you also have some sort of, I don't know, maximum income or something like that, I think that if you're going to be a public servant, you should be a public servant. You should
yes.
not be motivated by financial gain. And you also shouldn't receive the financial gain. Like I really do believe that. So I don't know exactly which of the levers needs to be pulled, but one of them does. We don't need to be subsidizing like amazing lifestyles for people who are likely to be way, way wealthier than us already.
I mean, what about just having them buy their own healthcare on the marketplace? If they're so into the ACA, I mean, this is the thing. I buy my healthcare on the marketplace. It's expensive as hell. It is super expensive. And like, and the taxes that I pay for it. And then I was like, oh, maybe I'm gonna qualify for some of the subsidies, you know, that Biden is passing in the American rescue plan. You know, it's like, and I didn't. I was like, you're qualified for $0. Like, damn it. Like it's absurd how much it is. And so again, the healthcare is like, I think Congress would take healthcare far more seriously if they were forced to also buy it on the marketplace. So I don't know if I want to subsidize that anymore.
Agreed. What's your number two?
Okay, my number two is Israel. $3 billion a year, roughly. Israeli occupation, now a vaccine apartheid in the occupied territories. Let's just stop. Look, we've given them a lot of money. They've got their own technology. They've got their own weapons. They're crushing it. I think we've done enough. And I think it's time to actually be honest actors in the Middle East. And I do not want any of my money going to Israel.
That's a great one. They have a thriving defense industry. They produce their own small arms, their own vehicles, their own stuff like that. Yeah, it feels much less like a need and more like a, this is a way for politicians to continue to show their support, to pay back those who give them donations. It's like the most clear case of that, I think. And very similar to the fossil fuel as well. Mm-hmm. That's a good, great one. My number two is going to be one that hopefully there will be less of now. There was some good news about Biden, who had, a couple weeks ago, they were like, yeah, some of those contracts with the border wall, we're just gonna like keep doing those. Then they backed off of it after a bunch of pushback. Mine is border wall funding, border security funding, interior detention facilities, actually prisons generally, the federal prison system. So much of it is completely unnecessary. They decided to put a bunch of money into it, which paid off a lot of people. They've crafted laws to produce a demand for a lot of these facilities. It's not necessary. It doesn't make our country better. We could save a lot of money and do a lot of good by not funding these sorts of things.
Oh, it's so good. I want to do that one. And I also forgot, I want like a runner up. A runner up is tax breaks for corporations to like make a town cushier for them to live in or to move into. So that's number one.
Yes.
I don't really feel that affects.
I was only thinking of federal taxes, really. You're totally right.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, living in LA, I'm not sure like we've necessarily done that, but I definitely know like it's happened. I guess given this year, given everything that's happened with the LAPD, Eric Garcetti, the violent removal of homeless encampments in places like Echo Park, I don't want my tax money to go to the police. And part of that, you know, we did pass Measure J in Los Angeles, which moved 10% of sort of general funds over to like health and housing services and mental health services. That's where I want my tax money to be going. LAPD, no more. You have had enough. So I want to not give my tax money to cops, even though I feel like that's where it's going anyway.
Yeah. No mas.
No mas. Basta.
Actually, uno mas.
Uno mas. What's
your number one? Oh, is that your number one?
That was my number one. Because my number five was like my number one.
Yes.
I know.
Yes, that's a good one. And that affects so many different things at so many different levels. So that is a good number one. It's not the best number one. Mine is the best number one, which was your number five, the military, obviously. Not only because of all the damage that's done with the money, not only the way that it's used to pay back industries that have given donations and all that, but also it's so much money. Oh my God, it's so much money. I am an idiot and not an expert, but I'm gonna say my gut says 75 to 85% cut would be totally fine. We'd save literally hundreds of billions of dollars every single year, many hundreds of billions of dollars every single year. We would do less damage in the world, and we could put that money into things that would objectively be better at the stated goal of protecting American lives and improving American lives, while also not devastating people in countries around the world. It is better in every way, other than from the point of view of politicians that don't want to face strike back from Fox News and want to keep getting donations from Raytheon and Lockheed Martin.
Yes.
Other than that, from everyone else's point of view, I think it is an obvious good, even if Americans have been trained to fight against even a $5 reduction in the defense budget on any given year.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the police rollout. Like, imagine we haven't even seen the amount of military like equipment and rollout in the bases. You know, like, where's our base report? I want to show me what you're doing with my taxpayer dollars, because I feel like it's not good. I feel like we don't need all those bases.
But also, yeah, I agree. But imagine how imagine how literally everyone, Joe Manchin, Nancy Pelosi, are gonna respond to hashtag defund the army. Imagine. Oh my God. Abolish Marines. Like, imagine. They would blow up in the way that normally things do only when our military is involved.
Keep the Navy.
Navy, they're fine. I like the Navy.
They're fine.
Coast Guard, definitely. Fine. Guard those coasts. I like it. The thing I like about the coasts is they're here. I like that part of the coasts.
Yeah.
Anyway. That said, that's our top 10 list. Were there any other runner-ups you wanted to mention?
No, just yours. Yours were great.
Thank you. I loved yours as well. I should have thought it was Israel too. Anyway, thank you everybody for being a member, making this possible. We love doing this little bit of extra content in for your support, and we hope you enjoy it. As always, if you have ideas for top 10 lists, whether political or not, feel free to post them down below, and you might get a shout out in a future video. But until then, we'll see you next time. It wasn't going to be difficult for 2021 to seem better in some fairly significant ways than 2020, but to be fair, it did start off in a pretty tumultuous fashion with attempts to overthrow the election that had just concluded a couple of months before, and hell breaking loose in a number of different state legislatures, with many Republicans at the state level responding to the national election losses by striking back against the new wave of voting. And out there, the movement that was defeated in the general election hasn't gone away and might be waiting, biding its time for the next election. So there's a lot going on, and I've been looking forward to taking stock with an individual that we last spoke to right in the aftermath of the 6th, actually. So we're very lucky to be joined once again by the Jacob Orosky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. Jason Stanley, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Very glad to have you here. I know you've been hard at work on your book, but a lot has been going on. And I've been curious, considering the conversations we've had over the past few years about American fascism, about political rhetoric, what are some of your thoughts about what's been going on recently across America?
I hate to be the sort of Holocaust survivor's kid and always say I'm deeply worried, but I am profoundly worried. I think what we're seeing right now, I saw a great tweet about this. I tweeted, the United States is going in the direction of Hungary. And I saw someone tweet, that's not true. The United States is going in the direction of the European Union, where certain states are gonna be like Poland and Hungary, no more democracy, bans on anything leftist in universities, free, you know, complete one party states run by the Republican juggernaut, conservative judges. This is familiar from the authoritarian countries in the EU of Hungary and Poland. And then you're gonna have states like Connecticut, who pretty much are, you know, functioning in reasonable ways, you know, given late stage capitalism. So I think that's a good way to think about it. We're seeing many states, I mean, Florida's law to illegalize, against rebellions and protests. I mean, I think rebellion is a good name. My colleague Elizabeth Hinton talks about this. Instead of protest and riot, which creates a kind of mistaken dichotomy. Oh, it's a protest unless someone throws a can, in which case it's a terrible riot, which is like, you know, if you're trapped in that, you're doing something nonsensical. So Elizabeth Hinton's new book, America on Fire, she says, if you look at Black Lives Matter and you look at back at the long history, at the rhetoric, at the political rhetoric, at what the police were saying about what was going on, they're political rebellions. And political rebellions often involve violence. So, you know, what we're having is we're having essentially authoritarian Russia style laws being employed against against protest. We're seeing Florida, we're seeing the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, get her powers taken away. We're seeing all across the country Jim Crow style. I mean, I wouldn't really call them Jim Crow style, because they're more influenced by Hungary. They're more influenced by the European authoritarian states, but they harken back to our Jim Crow past. And then finally, we're seeing in a kind of eternal recurrence, we're seeing patriotic education. We're seeing the thing that W.E.B. Du Bois in Black Reconstruction rails against. You know, we see people saying, we need patriotic education to bind the country together. And Du Bois in Black Reconstruction says, you know, history isn't about binding people together with lies. History is about telling the truth. You know, binding people with lies, you know, I mean, yes, we can talk about the noble lie, but you know, whitewashing the Confederacy, whitewashing white supremacy, and then is never going to result any good with any good. And also, as Du Bois emphasizes, it's the destruction of truth. And finally, we're seeing this terrible attack. All across the world, you have this attack on trans, this culture war against trans ideology. Each right-wing culture, America is so provincial. You know, if you have an international perspective, you know that each country tries a critical race theory locally. They try like some culture war, and if it doesn't work, they switch to another. So Poland started with immigrants, demonizing immigrants, but then it turned out there are no immigrants in Poland, so they moved to gays. And now it's like super harsh against homosexuality in Poland, terrifying. They're banning gay couples from adopting children. In the United States, all over the world, however, there's transgender ideology. There's this focus on transgender ideology. Because as Adam Sawyer points out, the transgender community is small enough, they can't really support themselves. And then, of course, because it's the United States, critical race theory. Always, 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 critical race theory, whites are under attack. In 1963, 46% of white people said it is just as easy for black and white members of our community to get a job in 1963. Now we're being told structural racism is over. I was like a complete misunderstanding of what structural racism is. So it's this same old theme. It is always the case that Americans want to think racism is and because they want to think that, they don't do much to end it.
Sure. You raised a lot of points, and I'd like to dive into a few of them. I mean, first of all, I'm curious about your thoughts about the juxtaposition of you pointed out the striking back against critical race theory. It's literally been banned in some states, including in Florida, at a time when one of the only things conservatives are talking about is how cancel culture is out of control. And even in particular, you know, the publisher of Dr. Seuss books choosing not to publish anymore is a terrible imposition for liberty. They are literally banning a philosophical framework from being discussed. That seems like a few people should take note of the hypocrisy, but so far they seem to have been able to make it work.
The level of hypocrisy is absurd at this point. I mean, with the Supreme Court justice, with cancel, so-called cancel culture, what we're seeing with critical race theory, it's just a search and replace with what Eastern Europe did with gender ideology. They banned gender ideology. And since it's America, in addition to gender ideology, because it's America, we have to ban critical race theory. It's not even clear what critical race theory is. What is critical race theory? There are many great black intellectuals, from Martin Delaney, Douglas, Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, to the present day, to Sadia Hartman, and others, Charles Mills, Patricia L. Collins. These are all theorists working in different perspectives who talk about the fact that that there are large racial disparities and there are ideological reasons for large racial disparities. And then what they do is they take this expression, meaningless expression, that is connected, because critical race theory, I mean, being critical about ideology does connect to Marx, because Marx wrote The German Ideology, which is about the ideology of capitalism. And so they're like, oh, it's all criticizing ideology. So it's this kind of nonsensical. And then the Frankfurt School has to be there because they're Jewish people. And so you got to have some Jewish, scary Jewish left-wing intellectuals. So, you know, America over and over again, leftist Jews and black radicals, you know, and of course, leftist Jews and black radicals have been among America's greatest intellectuals. And Angela Davis getting demonized when, you know, prison abolition has, whether you agree with it or not, has moved to the very forefront of debate in the ways that few philosophical programs have ever done. And this backlash, it's one of, frankly, the worst things I've seen in a democratic country. I'm disgusted. And of course, the reason it's there is because critical race theory has the number of the Republican parties. Why are they going after critical race theory? Because critical race theory says this is a white supremacist country that refuses to acknowledge its white supremacy. It refuses to acknowledge the discrepancies, structural racism. So they have to go after it. And they're going after gender ideology worldwide because these macho leaders who are destroying country after country are patriarchal and have the worst sins of patriarchy. So they have to go after gender ideology because gender ideology explains that too.
And they're also doing an absolutely horrible job of protecting their country. Some of the most, as you would point out, self-proclaimed almost macho politicians have the worst death counts internationally. One thing, so you talked there about.
I just want to pump the preface of my paperback, which was I had to send in to Penguin Random House on March 14th, 2020. And they said, you have to talk about COVID. And I said, no, what COVID hadn't even arrived in Brazil. I said, no one knows who's going to do badly on COVID. What am I supposed to say? So then I predicted that the three worst countries in COVID would be Brazil, the United States, and India, because their leaders were anti-science and fascist. So, I mean, I'm never about, but maybe we need to pay attention to the genocidal downstream aspects of the leaders we elect.
Yeah, and of being so fundamentally anti-science, anti-truth. Like I talked about in the intro, we last spoke in the aftermath of the 6th. And you know, I wonder about the similarity between you saying it's quite natural for them to be against critical race theory because critical race theory sort of asks people to recognize the history and current state of white supremacy in America, and they've sort of whitewashed that. At the same time that over the past few months, the 6th has been largely either ignored or rewritten. Tucker Carlson still does shows implying that there was no white supremacy there. It was perfectly fine. Those are good citizens, good patriots. And I don't know that in the immediate aftermath of it, I would have predicted that, seeing that footage, that they would risk trying to stand on the side of those insurrectionists, let alone that they would succeed in doing so. And the attempts, the wider attempts to overthrow the election have been largely whitewashed as well. Trump just in the last day put out a statement saying that the election itself was the big lie, not his efforts to overthrow it. So there's a lot that they're choosing not to recognize over the past few months.
So January 6th, I mean, you know, in a country that whitewashed torture, the massive torture regime, that whitewashed the genocidal Iraq war, that whitewashed the massively horrific financial crisis, that's whitewashed what I've called in print Trumpian genocide, and especially Bolsonaro's genocide with COVID. I'm not surprised they'd whitewashed January 6th. I mean, and when we look at the people in January 6th, I think of Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz. Myself, I'm Ted Cruz's age. You know, I'm a normal guy from Syracuse. I went to SUNY Binghamton while this dude was at Princeton and all the fanciest places in the world competing, you know, winning every debate prize. He was the elite of the elite of the elite. You know, I became a philosophy professor because I wrote a bunch of books that made hits, but he was the elite of the elite of the elite. And he's leading an anti-democratic, quasi-fascist coup. So, you know, the failures here, the failures start at the top. You know, the failure of the Democratic, the Republican Party, you know, Democratic and Republican Party both flirted deeply with white supremacy. The 90s was a massive disaster for anti-black racism in the Democratic Party, with super predator theory at all. But the Republican Party has become an anti-democratic party. They've become an explicitly anti-democratic party. On every political science measure, they're an extreme far-right European party. But they're not just an extreme far-right European party on abortion, on taxes, on health, on gun control, on climate change. We're the only major conservative party to deny climate change. They are an anti-democratic party.
Yeah. Fundamentally, we're seeing that play out in states around the country. One last topic I want to talk to you about, because we could talk for a long time, but we're going to have to unfortunately cut it short at some point. And hopefully we can touch base continually as this proceeds. It's been a few months. Trump has really not been out front. He still gets talked about by the right, clearly. He occasionally makes little media appearances, but he hasn't really been a big front and center vocal part of the movement. And I wonder, from your point of view, to what extent are you currently feeling like it matters? Like, you're talking about what some of these governors and state legislators are doing. Right-wing media has, they've picked what they're gonna focus on. As we cruise towards the midterms in 2024, how important is Donald Trump's future to this movement?
Neither of us know the answer to that question. Donald Trump Jr. is up there in the Republican National Convention. We always have to remember, I mean, lots of people are complaining about rent in various ways, and I'm not gonna, I don't feel like being like, oh, you're citing Arendt again. But Arendt makes this great point that about vulgarity, that politicians can be popular because people know that the opposition regards them as vulgar and gross. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Republicans are like, wouldn't it be great if Donald Trump Jr. was president and the liberals would have to, like, you know, kiss Donald Trump's Jr.'s butt. So those kinds of things are worrisome. but we have, and that was how Trump came to be as well. But we have, we also have DeSantis, who has shown himself to be a smart, far-right, authoritarian, anti-democratic leader. You know, of the Eastern European variety, you know, targeting democracy just systematically with no, really no principles at all when it comes to voting and democracy and those issues. Very strong authoritarian into huge penalties for protests, for rebellions, so to skirt the protest riot. A false dichotomy. So DeSantis is deeply worrisome. I'm always going on about Tucker Carlson as a problem, but in general, the whole damn country, we've got these structural issues where the Supreme Court is very far right. The Senate, you know, is we have these massive structural issues, so our political system, you know, Biden is doing these great domestic things. I'm not sure his foreign policy is up to snuff, but domestically he's trying to do these things. And we'll have to see if they have effects on voting, and we'll have to see whether these draconian voter suppression bills ensconce a permanent Republican Party like they have in so many states.
Yeah. That was fascinating. I wish that we could go on, and I really do hope that I know that you're busy, book coming out and all that, but let's definitely continue the conversation as things develop. A lot on the line with the things that we're talking about here. So as always, Jason Stanley, we appreciate you joining us.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.